Where there's a will, there's a way. I first met Will back in 2001 when we had just set up Pistachios in the park. He rode into the cafe on his bike, his dad, Kevin, and little brother following close behind. With his unforgettable cheeky grin and a feeding tube emerging from his nose, he immediately struck up a conversation, speaking to me as if we'd known each other forever. While Kevin ordered a latte for himself and an ice cream for his younger son, Will kept chatting away, his eyes brightening when I mentioned that I too had three boys, the youngest about his size and, by sheer coincidence, sharing the same name as his little brother Josh. It felt like fate slipping quietly into the conversation. From that moment, the friendship between our families seemed inevitable. Will and Josh became inseparable, kicking a football until the sun dipped behind the trees, tearing around the park on their bikes, their laughter trailing behind them like ribbons. On three occasions, they joined us in the great river of cyclists that poured through the city for charity rides. Our little group swept along with hundreds of others. I remember one ride in particular. Knowing my own lack of stamina, I cleverly volunteered myself as guardian of the younger riders, thinking it would buy me a slower pace. Yet not long after we set off, I was the one gasping for breath, leaning heavily on my handlebars as I called for a rest stop. The children, all of them, including Will, rolled their eyes and groaned at the unnecessary pause, restless to get moving again. That was Will through and through. For someone who had carried illness with him his whole life, he never let it define him. He refused to be downhearted or bitter. He simply pressed forward, keeping pace with the others, as if determination itself was his secret fuel. After Kevin and Lorraine moved to Norwich, we heard that Will had taken a turn for the worse and needed both a bowel and liver transplant. We all prayed for his recovery, hoping against hope that he would pull through. So it was with absolute joy that we welcomed Will back for a visit sometime later. It was a moment I will never forget, watching him, without a feeding tube for the first time, standing in line at the cafe with his dad, ordering a chocolate ice cream just like any other kid. That memory stayed with me, and I couldn't help but smile when I heard Lorraine's speech at the funeral. She recalled that just before his first transplant, Will had said, "Where there's a will, there's a way." It was a phrase that perfectly captured his spirit, his determination, his positivity, and his unwavering courage. He never showed the pain or fear he must have felt. He simply lived, with a heart full of joy and an energy that inspired everyone around him. Truly, he was a hero of all heroes. To Kevin, Lorraine, Ben, Sophie, and Josh, we salute you for having been blessed with such an incredible soul in your lives. His absence will be deeply felt by all who knew him, but his spirit will live on in the countless lives he touched. We are honored to have known you, Will. With love, Asen, Diane, Ben, Caitlin, Remy, Theo, and Josh Tree planning at Manor House Gardens in memory of William Tweedy. Life was good. We had entered a new millennium and were making great progress in our new business venture in the park. My boys were happy, and I was still living at 28 Old Road, a 2-minute walk from the park. The house sat on a bend where Old Road curved to the left. On our wall, there was an old sign dating back to World War II that read, "Shelter for 600," with an arrow pointing toward the gardens. In Manor House Gardens, there was an underground ice house where the residents of the manor house once stored large chunks of ice to preserve fresh meat. To our immediate right stood Pentland House, which at the time served as a hall of residence for Goldsmiths College. In fact, we had purchased our house from Goldsmiths College in 1988 for £112,000, a 4-bedroom end-of-terrace property with a cellar. We had begun renovating, reconfiguring the downstairs into 2 reception rooms and a large kitchen with French doors opening onto a south-facing garden. We also installed a state-of-the-art CP Hart walk-in shower with a 3-bar shower pump. Martin and Fred fitted the walls-end tiles, and we tanked out the cellar, converting it into a small kids' den and PlayStation room for my sons and their friends. However, when Sally was diagnosed with her tumor in 1992, the renovations came to a halt. Every available fund, mostly non-existent, was quickly drained by the immense but essential costs of surgery abroad. After Sally passed away, I was devastated, lost in a void I didn't know how to fill. Yes, I had my boys, the greatest gift she ever gave me, and they kept me going during the day. But once they were tucked up in bed and the house fell quiet, the emptiness would hit me hard. The grief crept in during those silent hours, and the weight of it often sank into something darker, something like depression. Fred, my close friend, became a quiet lifeline during that time. He'd show up unannounced, often late in the evening, with a bottle of brandy pulled from the inside pocket of his jacket. We'd sit, take a few slow sips, and talk. Sometimes we'd reminisce. Sometimes I'd just talk, and he'd simply listen. Never rushing me, never judging. He gave space for my mourning, offering words of comfort and gentle encouragement when I needed them most. When he noticed the fatigue start to set in, he'd quietly screw the cap back onto the bottle, slide it back into his jacket, and head home, only to return again the next evening. He kept this up for months, never making a fuss, never expecting anything in return, just showing up as true friends do until I could begin to find my feet again. I was broken out of work, but with sheer determination, resilience, and a few failed attempts in different fields, I eventually got back on my feet in catering. By then, I was in a relationship with Diane, and we were discussing moving in together. My house, with its size, was the more practical option, but we needed to make some alterations to accommodate her two children. Diane agreed to help with the finances. In fact, while I was away on my stag weekend, she secretly planned a full front garden makeover as a surprise. With the help of Charles Hutton, a local horticulturist, she designed a stunning wraparound garden with decking, a water feature, and railway sleepers. Friends, family, and volunteers all pitched in, working tirelessly to complete the transformation. While I was in Spain, drinking and making a fool of myself, Diane was back home, working around the clock. When I returned, I was met with an incredible surprise. Diane, Charles, and the whole team standing there with champagne in hand, waiting to see my reaction as Diane unveiled her beautiful design. It was a truly heartwarming moment. After Sally passed away, I was completely lost. Grief had swallowed me whole. But in the midst of it, messages and calls poured in from friends near and far, each offering their condolences and kind words. One of them was Steve Harrison in New Zealand, a man who had worked with Sally years earlier at E.F. Hutton, a Eurobond bank in the city of London. Although we hadn't spoken in years, Steve reached out personally, and to this day, without fail, he still messages me every December 7th on my birthday. It's one of those small but powerful gestures that stays with you. Another acquaintance we made was an Australian couple we met while they were backpacking across Europe, using London as their base. We ended up renting them the flat above our deli in East Greenwich, where we used to live. When Ben was born, we moved to a two-bedroom flat on Wickham Road in Brockley, SE4, South London. Cara, the wife, got a job as a sales assistant at Harrods, while her husband Tom landed a position at Which Magazine, where he would go on to excel. Cara often shared how tough and unpleasant it was working at Harrods. The environment was high pressure, especially whenever Al Fayed himself did his infamous walkabouts through the store. At the time, there was a wave of counterfeit 10-pound, 20-pounds, and 50-pound notes and fraudulent credit cards, so staff had to be extra vigilant. One of Cara's friends, who worked in a specific department, once found herself in a tricky situation. A customer entered with a large entourage and began racking up a bill in the thousands. When the sales assistant asked for ID to verify his credit card, the customer couldn't provide any. He seemed offended, and tension rose until someone in his entourage pulled out a banknote, presumably from the man's home country, and pointed to the image on the note, saying it was the same person trying to make the purchase. Despite the pressure, the assistant followed protocol and declined the sale. Unfortunately, the man turned out to be of Middle Eastern royal descent and lodged a complaint directly with Al Fayed. As a result, Kara's friend was fired on the spot, despite having done everything by the book. Though Harrods was glamorous on the surface, Cara never enjoyed working there. Tom, on the other hand, loved his job in magazine publishing. After retiring and moving back to Adelaide, Australia, he went on to establish his own media company, HWR Media and Communications. To this day, we keep in regular contact, and we always meet up whenever Tom visits the UK. It's on my bucket list to one day visit Australia and properly catch up with Tom, and hopefully also with Steve in New Zealand. Another friend, Steve Charsley, was a talented mechanical engineer who had worked alongside Richard Piper, a Class 2 motor racing driver. Steve ran the mechanical team, constantly fine-tuning and redesigning the car to improve its speed and performance. Years earlier, he'd also helped Sally and me convert our second delicatessen in Central Greenwich into a cafe, after we'd quickly realized we'd made a mistake with the original concept. Eventually, Steve moved on from racing and relocated to Florida, where he joined his brother-in-law's real estate venture. They found success and decided to expand into Marbella, Spain. Soon after, Steve branched out on his own, founding a new agency called Marbella Now, with financial support from his friend David Binks. At the time, Spain's property market was booming, with an influx of expats chasing a sunnier, more relaxed life. Steve married a Russian woman named Svetlana, and together they had a baby boy. Svetlana already had a daughter, Sophia, a bright, beautiful 4-year-old from a previous relationship. Unfortunately, Svetlana began suffering from severe mental health issues, creating a dangerous environment for both herself and the children. Steve's mother flew over to help with the baby, while Steve tried to manage both his growing business and the increasingly unstable home situation. One day, Steve called me with a difficult request. Would I take care of Sophia in the UK? I imagine he thought, since I was already raising my 3 boys alone, I could handle one more. And truthfully, I couldn't say no. He was a friend in need, and he trusted me. Sophia arrived shortly after, moving into what used to be the au pair's room. She spoke only Russian, but had a charming, curious spirit. I managed to get her a place at Bright Sparks Nursery on Lampmead Road, just a short walk from Josh's school. Each morning, Ben and Remy would head off to school on their own, while I walked Sophia to nursery, then Josh to school, before heading to work at the cafe in the park. Diane's sister Jenny helped with school pickups, since her son Sean was in Josh's class and the two were close friends. Though communication with Sophia was limited at first, we quickly discovered that she absolutely loved eggs, especially boiled, and had a real thing for strawberry ice cream. She was a joy to have around, even if there were frequent wet beds and a tendency to bite the boys. I couldn't bring myself to scold her. I'd simply changed the sheets and carried on. The boys adored having her around, even knowing it was only temporary. Steve was beyond grateful. Eventually, he made the tough decision to divorce Svetlana and seek full custody of both his son and Sophia. After a lengthy legal battle, he succeeded. During all this, Steve continued urging me to move to Spain and open a restaurant, insisting that my talents were wasted in a local park cafe. And honestly, I came close. It was my first proposal to Diane, and it failed. I had built it up in my mind as the moment everything would change. I loved her, fiercely, unshakably, and I convinced myself that if we were married, she might finally move in full-time, no longer drifting in and out of our lives with only weekends to offer. One crisp morning, I gathered Caitlin and the boys and drove to Hatton Garden, the glittering heart of London's jewelry trade. Shop windows blazed with gold and diamond light as we wandered past. I leaned down to Caitlin and told her my plan. I wanted her help choosing the perfect ring for her mum. I thought by including her, Diane would see the truth of my intentions, that I valued not only her, but the family we were weaving together. It wasn't just a proposal, it was a promise to all of us. But when the moment finally came, when I slipped the ring into Diane's hands, everything crumbled. She shook her head, refused, and quietly returned it. Just like that, the dream I had carried shattered. We agreed to take a break, though deep down I knew it was more than that. It was a fracture, one that might never heal. At the same time, another part of my life was closing in on its own ending. The lease on our old Leagate restaurant had run its course. Tony, the gifted Thai chef who had taken it over, had fallen desperately ill and could no longer keep the kitchen alive. His wife tried valiantly to hold it together, but the weight was too much. After one difficult conversation, she admitted defeat. I triggered the break clause, and with it, another chapter of my life was sealed shut. For the first time, the thought of Spain didn't feel like a dream. It felt possible. Still, I wasn't ready to leap without a net. I reached out to Atan, a brilliant Malaysian chef and dear friend, His career had once carried him into the gilded kitchens of the Sultan of Brunei, following the royal family across the world before he finally settled in France, where he met his wife, Yute. Fate later drew them to Lewisham, where our lives entwined. I asked Atan and Yute if they would consider Spain, running a restaurant with me, building something new. Quietly, I admitted to myself that if things with Diane truly ended, I would almost certainly follow. To prepare, I had all my restaurant equipment shipped to Marbella, tucked away in storage like buried treasure, waiting for its second life. I began traveling to the Costa del Sol often, staying in one of Steve's empty flats. Each trip felt like a rehearsal for reinvention. Spain began to whisper to me, of freedom, of possibility. It also brought Sophia back into my orbit. She had returned to Spain and was thriving under her stepfather's care. Her life steadied again. Even as London seemed to unravel beneath me, Spain pulled harder, offering the promise of a new beginning just over the horizon. I found a promising location for a restaurant down at a marina in Estepona, just south of Marbella. It looked ideal, and I struck what I thought was a great deal with a local agent. I flew back to the UK feeling optimistic, planning to return as soon as possible, this time with Atan and Yute in tow, so they could see the space and discuss running the pizza bistro together. I'd already come up with a name, Pizza Pona. When we arrived in Estepona, we met the agent at a bar, fittingly named Cheers. While we chatted, Atan, Yute, and I were approached by a young woman and her mother who asked if I was the guy behind Pistachios in Greenwich and Blackheath. They used to live in Greenwich and were regulars at the cafe. They'd always loved the vibe we created and said, other than the allure of the Spanish sun, it was something they deeply missed. They were thrilled to recognize me and to have their hunch confirmed. Unfortunately, that lovely encounter backfired. The agent's demeanor shifted. He assumed I was some wealthy entrepreneur with multiple successful UK locations and suddenly decided I could afford to pay more. Just like that, he inflated the rental price we had agreed on 2 weeks earlier by a third. I was shocked and frankly disgusted. Greed had gotten the better of him. Naturally, I pulled out of the deal and told him I'd find somewhere else, and I did. I discovered another spot much further south, closer to Gibraltar, in a charming little port town called Puerto de la Duquesa. It wasn't far from Soto Grande, where Stephen was planning to open his second real estate office. Things felt like they might align again. Back in Lewisham, there was a woman I had known for a while, Philippa, a striking redhead who used to come into our cafes in Greenwich and Blackheath with her elderly partner, Ken. They were a sweet, sociable couple. Philippa had seen me during some of the hardest moments of my life, carrying Sally into the cafe when she was too weak to walk, placing her gently in a chair, feeding her, caring for her with love and devotion. After Sally passed and I opened the cafe in Manor House Gardens, Philippa started turning up again, but now she was on her own. She and Ken had split. She drove a BMW convertible, wore high heels, leopard print leggings, low-cut blouses, and bold red lipstick. She had a magnetic smile and carried herself with confidence. Not my usual type, but I couldn't deny she turned heads wherever she went. The boys, especially Remy, were quite taken with her. She made it very clear she was interested in me. She worked nights as a restaurant manager in Greenwich and loved the hospitality world. She couldn't understand how my ex-girlfriend, Diane, didn't want to live or work with me. Philippa said that if we were together, she'd move in full-time and be at my side in the cafe. I'll admit, I was tempted. I was lonely. I missed companionship. Eventually, I gave in and we started a relationship. I didn't bring her into the cafe, though. It felt too complicated. Diane's mom, Opal, was still helping out, and Diane had financially supported the cafe's initial setup in the park. Even though Diane and I were separated, it felt wrong to bring someone new into that shared space. But I did give Philippa a key to my house. She would come home to me after her evening shifts, quietly letting herself in while I was already asleep. For a while, it felt like the right move, or so I thought. But the truth was, I didn't feel for Philippa what I felt for Diane, and yet Diane hadn't accepted my proposal either. It was confusing and emotionally draining. Then one morning, Philippa walked over to the cafe with me, and we kissed goodbye. Unbeknownst to me, Caitlin was in the park and saw everything. Mortified, she ran home and told her mum. Soon after, Diane's ex, Philip, came by the cafe. He was a regular on Fridays when he picked up Theo for the weekend. That day, he told me that Caitlin had seen me kissing someone and was devastated. Diane was also hurt. It had only been a short time since our breakup, and it was clear to her I had moved on. Philip mentioned that Diane still had feelings for me, but struggled with trust and long-term commitment. I told him that I still loved her, but what could I do? She had turned down my proposal, and I was in my 40s now, feeling time slip by. A few days later, Diane came to the cafe to confront me. I defended myself the only way I could. I said I wanted a committed relationship, something she hadn't been ready to offer. I admitted I still had feelings for her. To my surprise, she said she felt the same, but needed more time to adjust and fully commit. That was all I needed to hear. I made up my mind then and there. I had to end things with Philippa. I owed it to myself and to Diane if we had any chance of moving forward. Telling Philippa wasn't easy. It didn't go down well, but it was the right thing to do. When I told Atan and Ute about the new location I'd found, I expected them to be excited, ready to jump in and start this new venture with me. But instead, Atan told me that while he was still committed, Ute wasn't on board, so they wouldn't be partnering with me after all. I was a little disappointed at first, but truthfully, I also felt relieved. With things starting to fall back into place with Diane, the idea of moving to Spain no longer felt right. I decided to pull out of the negotiations and arrange to have all the catering equipment shipped back to the UK. I eventually sold everything at a catering auction run by Hilditch in Malmesbury. Despite the change of plans, Atan and I have stayed close friends to this day. When Diane and I finally reconciled, I was over the moon. It felt like a second chance at something truly special. But beneath that joy was a heavy weight. Caitlin had taken the breakup hard, and her anger toward me cut deep. Watching her struggle with our reunion was heartbreaking. It took time, patience, and more love than I thought I had to give for her to slowly accept that her mom and I were serious about building a life together. Diane had agreed to move in, and we'd already made room for her two kids, doing everything we could to make them feel welcome and at home. We'd even gone as far as building a bespoke loft room for Caitlin, imagining it would be her own little sanctuary. But her fear of spiders, something I hadn't truly understood until then, made it impossible for her to sleep there. She was terrified, and no amount of reassurance could change that. So the loft room ended up going to Ben and Remy, who'd been sharing a room until then. They were absolutely buzzing with excitement. The space had its own bathroom, a comfy sofa, a walk-in wardrobe, and a huge Velux window. What I didn't know at the time was that they'd discovered they could open the window and climb out onto the dome-shaped roof above Josh's bedroom. That little secret stayed hidden for a while, but when I eventually found out, I couldn't help but laugh at their boldness, even if it gave me a mild heart attack.